the trick is to do what you want and stay alive just the same. And I have lived. I lived in your reckless touch, this flood. It was enough. You succumbed to sleep, and then I watched you each time our bodies reflected in a crystal and glass paperweight. I watched your face as you slept. The rats were miles away.
You're listening to a Scottish Poetry Library podcast.
Hello, this is Jennifer Williams, Programme Manager at the Scottish Poetry Library, and I'm so pleased to be sitting here today with Jenny Lindsay. Jenny is a poet, performer, and promoter of spoken word. She's based in Edinburgh, though I don't think I really realise this. You grew up in a place called Mabel?
Mabel, yes.
Yeah. That sounds quite charming.
It does sound charming, doesn't it?
It makes me think of sort of space swings with, girls wearing daisy crowns or something, but maybe not. And also, I'm not sure I realised this either, that you began your career as a singer-songwriter. Though I know you're an amazing singer and
that's very, very kind of you.
We were in a band a very wonderful band. So you had performed your lyrics at Nice and Sleazy's open mic sessions in Glasgow, went on to become a finalist of one of the first Big Word Poetry Slams in 2002, which has launched your magnificent career for poet's poetry. You've continued to perform and compare at events across the UK, including appearances at the Edinburgh International Book Festival, Stanza, Belfast Cathedral Quarter Arts Festival, and Latitude, where you were even very recently.
Last week, yes.
Yeah. Your poetry is featured on BBC Radio Scotland and the BBC World Service, among others. I think that's so cool. Did you have to talk in a very posh way?
I did, actually, because the commission was to do a poem in the voice of David Cameron. So I had to.
Oh my God, I love it. Your debut collection, The Things You Leave Behind, was published by Red Squirrel Press in 2011. And your most recent pamphlet is the marvellously titled The Egypt Pit. You probably say that even better than I do. I'm not sure.
Egypt Pit.
Which came out with Steve Rhubarb in 2012. You're also a teacher, you run workshops, you've worked with all sorts of different poetry and performance organizations, and you are, of course, one half of the marvellous literary cabaret duo Rally and Broad alongside poet Rachel McCrum. So you are a busy lady, and we're lucky to have you here. But I'm really looking forward to talking to you about all sorts of things, but I'll let you kick off with a poem to start.
I'll kick off with my love poem, I guess, to Edinburgh, which is very originally entitled Edinburgh. Edinburgh, oh Edinburgh. Edinburgh, you old tart, trussed up in fairy lights, trancing those curious ones with your curios and tartan bric-a-brac, your knickers out to dry, hanging aside the rest, your dirty washing flaps as your packaged history blows, wind seeps through back alley ghost tours and matching American tracksuits. Edinburgh, you rebel child, a glass affronted mock to your elders, those eyesore panics you've erected, shocking the heart of your big brothers. Edinburgh, you cobbly codger, you completely unremarked upon eccentric. Edinburgh, you bacchanalian dream for pagans and dreadlocked fire eaters, alongside a career in buy-to-let, nudity forges with superiority. Painted green or blue or red, you turn around to your naked friend. Atop a hill you burn the flame of new religion, old superstition. The lines that draw, the needles take, the streets where shopping trolleys carve mark the way from kitchen sink chic to broken windowed chip shop reel. Carve away from class tourists and trustafarians. Not all roads lead to Princess Street. Your controversial masonry, your sniggeringly greedy cash registers, your 5 quid pints of Peroni, your artists and your poetry. Edinburgh, you apple pie bed, you warm and scratchy shocker. How we walk you, gingerly, like a first attempt over burning coals, It's all about the pressure you put on the surface. Cute.
I think that poem we were just talking about, how the city feels like it's getting ready for the festival. It's this funny feeling you get at this time of the year. Things start, more people are appearing, and various structures are being built all around the city. And that poem feels especially right for this time of year. So
yeah.
I love the apple pie.
I usually whip it out in August. So
it's so nice. You have stayed in Edinburgh for quite some time now.
Indeed.
And do you feel like it's your home? Or?
I do. Yeah. I absolutely love Edinburgh. I fell in love with Edinburgh when I was 17, and I came up in the summer just before I came up to start university at Queen Margaret University College, as it was. Coming from Ayrshire, I was just like, oh my God, look at the buildings, they are so big. And I felt very small, and I loved it. Just such a great city to be an artist in as well, because it's such a city of contrast. You know, on the one hand, it's this amazing financial hub and tourist centre, and it's also got serious drug issues and immense poverty, and that's the kind of thing that I write about. So Edinburgh. Two cities.
Yes. I was going to ask you, I somehow was going to wait, but I feel like now might be just as good a time as any to start talking about this. It does feel to me, I mean, you have been, well, I don't know, I'd be curious to know what you think about this. It seems to me you have been able to be political, a political poet or political alongside of your poetry.
Yeah.
For instance, you've done some wonderful work for the Yes campaign or the Independence
campaign with National Collective
for Scotland. And we had this transatlantic poetry broadcast with John Burnside and Lucy Brock Broido, the American poet, on Sunday evening. And we were talking about whether poetry can be political. Anyway, so I asked Lucy, do you think poetry is good for talking about politics? And she actually said she doesn't think poetry is political, which is quite interesting. And then John Burnside said, or you could say all poetry is political.
Yeah.
But I kind of wanted to pose that to you and see what you thought.
I think personally, as a poet, I actually find it really difficult to write about politics directly. For example, you'd think for someone who was so involved with National Collective and the Yes Movement, I would actually have a poem about independence, and I don't at all. I find it really difficult to write about it. But what I have done is sort of come at the issue sideways, looked at some of the characters or some of the issues within it, and I've been really inspired by being involved in the campaign as well. But directly doing some kind of pro-independence poem is not something I would ever be able to do. I mean, we get sent a lot of them to National Collective, but it's not something I myself could ever do. I think I like to write about people. So if I was going to, and I have been trying actually, I'm trying to write one at the moment called Drinking with Jason, where Jason is this sort of old grizzler and he's sitting in a pub. The Windsor Buffet is the one that's in my head, and he's having a chat about independence, and he's sitting with a no voter and a don't know, and so I'm working in that piece just now, but I really don't have very much longer that I could actually do this poem, so I better get it cracking, let's face it. I think poetry's great for being political, but coming at the issue sideways rather than sort of head on, I always find that a more successful piece of art than sort of lecturing at people. Obviously with performance poetry we do have a lot of sort of, you know, grandstanding and soapboxing, and I'm a big fan of that. I will say I do love a good polemical, ranty performance poem, but I'm not particularly great at writing them myself. So.
I mean, I think often because poetry is so good at things like metaphor and coming at things, talking about one thing by talking about another thing. Actually, it's exactly, I think sideways is such a good way to describe it, because being able to do it from sideways and underneath and up above gives you that subtlety that makes a poem reverberate and have more meaning in the long run. But I do like that idea. I've ascribed to this for a long time, that art making in general is a political act, because it's an act for the good, shall we say.
Exactly.
It's part of making the world, sharing some personal truth about our way of moving through the world, that does feel very different from, I don't know, like shooting someone, or it's a force for good in the world, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Hopefully. So, yes, well, performance poetry.
Yes.
So, I mean, this is probably the sort of question one gets asked all the time, and
I love it. Yeah. I love this discussion.
Oh, good, good. Obviously, there's been, well, it's something I've been thinking about a lot recently, that people ask me about what's going on in Edinburgh,
mm-hmm.
the different kinds of nights in Edinburgh, and I think one of the exciting things
mm-hmm.
is that it feels like, when I first came here in 2001, it was like performance poetry where you had to memorize your poems and then there was like, and there were nights where that seemed really the
mm-hmm.
tradition or the case. And then there were other ones which were like much more open, and then there were some which were like literary, you only read here if you have a book and you're reading from the
and
book.
And you're published and blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
But it feels so much more open now.
Yeah, it's
like,
brilliant, isn't it?
It feels way more like that's been blown out of the water. I was just at a poetry slam the other day where
mm-hmm.
I think more of the competitors were reading than just performing memorized poems and doing beautiful performances, even though they had a piece of paper in their hand. And vice versa, I've seen poets even at book festivals.
Mm-hmm.
Traditionally, the book is
mm-hmm.
the kind of shining idol in the book festival, where they've got the book somewhere, you know, on the podium, but they're definitely performing memorized poems. So, yeah, what do you think about it all?
I think that sums up really nicely.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I started out when I was 20, I was very much of a sort of writing for slams, being a performance poet, memorizing everything, blah, blah, blah. But then, you know, I wanted to explore different ways of writing. I started writing more sort of longer, more narrative pieces, more like storytelling. And you know, I did have a fairly good memory, but you know, I came to the point I had to have a book with me because they were so long. And I actually, you know, I absolutely love performed poetry. You know, the image that comes into people's head when you say performance poet, I do love that style of performance and poetry. But I think that over the course of a night, which is the main thing that I do, is organise sort of programmes of nights. Over the course of a night, you want some variation, you want some difference there, and you don't to be a good performer. And I know this is the divide. This is where the divide comes out. But to be a good performer, you do not need to have memorised your piece. It's about the voice. It's about control of the voice. It's about the images that you can bring to an audience without them having to see what you have in front of you. And to me, that is performed poetry, perhaps not what we would think of as a performance poet doing it, but at the end of the day, the events that I run, they are about, you know, engaging an audience, and however an artist wants to do that is completely up to them. And I certainly think that the scene is so much healthier now that perhaps more sort of traditional poetry readings do have an element of spoken word, and more sort of live literature events, or whatever we want to call them, do you have a good combination of your slam performance poets and poets who write for the page primarily. I think the scene is so much better for it, definitely.
And it's interesting you saying that, because it makes me think as well, I haven't really thought about it in this way, but potentially then there is more influence going on
mm-hmm.
between
yeah.
the forms, like in terms of the actual writing
mm-hmm.
in poems, which is really exciting. Because, again, I think you could have maybe in the past and not so much now really defined a
mm.
performance poem and a page poem
mm-hmm.
in a kind of formal terms.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that would be much harder to do now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that I suppose I can speak personally. I know that I at least attempt to work out how on earth my poems would work on a page now, whereas I really didn't used to at all. I mean, you should see, putting this pamphlet together actually was hilarious, because I've never formally studied poetry or anything. I've got no bloody idea how they should look on the page. I write them for how I speak. So I handed them to James Harding. He was like, Jenny, we have to have a chat. It's like you're putting in sort of grammatical things that are clearly for you as a performer to, you know, the ellipsis are just overuse throughout. And he was like, right, we have to have a chat. So yeah, I mean, I think that's obviously a good professional development and thing that I've had to look at, because I think there's some performance poets say, no, you should never put it on the page, you know, it's a fluid beast, it will change over time. And I'm like, eh, you know, it's like, to me, this pamphlet that is in front of us here, and it's like, a book of song lyrics. You listen to a song and then you can read the lyrics and the in sleep, I'm showing my age now, CDs. I wanted to have a pamphlet plus pretty.
It's so gorgeous.
It's James Harding is such a good designer.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, specifically something like Stewed Rhubarb is so interesting because it's a press that almost specialises in making books of performance poetry, doesn't it? And even Red Squirrel was here on Saturday launching Matt MacDonald, Chris Young, and Colin Maguire, all three really, I see, mostly
in the performance
very scene. Much in a performance context. And it was exciting to see those two pamphlets and Colin's full collection, you know, and flipping through them and seeing how they appeared on the page. And yeah, they looked great. And it was really nice, you know, I think that thing of being able to read along when you are hearing a poet as well is it's really great. Yeah, I do always wonder, you know, if it'd be nice to have a CD with them almost, you know, to get this sound.
Kath McMahon, she did that along with her pamphlet, and she had a CD with recordings and music, and she did that. I'm not so, for myself, I'm not so into the CDs. I use them in workshops sometimes, but I find it very difficult to listen to my own voice, but I personally don't spend a lot of time listening to spoken word CDs, so I much prefer it. And realistically, not very many people who've not seen me perform are going to actually buy it, so just be realistic, not self-deprecating here. So,
but it's nice to go to a show and be able to take the words home. But I do think that, you know, it's exciting to see these poems on the page, and it's really interesting that thinking about that process of when you are accustomed to performing poems. And I think I was going to ask you about this as well, like about the editorial process with performance poems versus printed poems, which we've sort of been talking about. But I don't know if you find this, I think one of the best way to edit poems is to do them on stage, because as you're speaking them and getting a response from an audience, it's one of the best ways to know rhythmically what's working in terms of content, whether people are understanding, laughing, crying, that response is so useful. But then also, I suppose that's one editorial process, and then as you were just describing, the putting the text on the page is a whole other editorial process, both of them probably equally useful. But it's interesting to think of the poem going through these different
experiences. That Edinburgh one, that was just like a big, it just looked like a piece of prose when it was in this. See, obviously people can't see this, but I've got sort of three books in front of me. One of them is my pamphlet, one of them is my extremely tattered old book, and one of them is my book of ones not yet published. It is a total mess, as you can see.
It looks very neat to me. It's really, all beautifully pasted in.
There's highlighted bits.
There are notes written in, which is quite cool.
There's like bits.
So those are like edits that you've made along the way.
And some of them have sort of pauses and line breaks built into
it. Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, I think I need to redo that one.
But see, this is lovely because you've got them, you can actually see the annotations of that process going on.
Yeah.
Oh, very cool. So this is the kind of thing, you know, like now you can buy a book of, you know, all the edits to The Wasteland or something. So you have to keep that.
I've got one of 1984. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, so you have to keep all this so then that all this can all be published as the notes and annotations to the text.
I would make me a true charlatan, but you know, if anyone wants to do that for me.
Maybe it would be good now to have another poem.
Yes, okay. In fact, I just mentioned 1984, so that probably helps. This is a bit of a longer poem that I'm going to do. One of the things that we do at Rallying Broad is we have a theme each month, and this one was written for our Heroes and Anti-Heroes one in November, a few months ago. I wrote my dissertation on George Orwell, so I'm kind of like totally obsessed with what I'm doing this with you. But in 1984, we're looking at heroes and anti-heroes, and actually I thought Julia, who has no surname, I thought that she was actually the real hero. And so I wrote a love letter from Julia to Winston Smith, and it's called Reckless as a Flood. Reckless as a flood, tsunami force, each thrust a victory, the climax a history, to the quiet death of the afterwards, the head and chest, the eyes elsewhere. You see, the more people you've had, the more I love you. Do you understand that? That we, depressed, are the best lovers. We always think that we're doing it for the last time. Do you understand that? I do, my love. Each climax, a victory, a political act. This is not the world they taught us. This is not what we learned at our surrogate mother's knees. The screens blared efficiency, pragmatic partnerships, betrayal when necessary. We'll defy them till our eyes water, nod and smile at the anti-sex league who are actively making our pornography. They know nothing but thrust, with no victory. I have joined them. I've tied my waist sash tighter with a hint of out of reach that will make them reach, that made you notice me, my love. Give me your agency, that little spark. Take wanting to smash my head in with a rock, wanting to defile me in ways you've been forced to imagine through the habitual act of spilling seed alone, angry, consumed by hate week, confused by touch and the utter absence of love. Say it. Love. I love you, Winston, with your silly, sorry inevitabilism. The trick is to do what you want and stay alive just the same. You would throw acid in a child's face for a cause you know nothing about. I already know you will betray me. But for now, this is the real stuff. This is the golden country. My clothes discarded easily, our uniforms mere cloth. There is no victory product named so with no hint of irony. And you didn't know this. You thought I fell asleep too easily when you were trying to educate me in your sorry love, dreary revolutionary thought. But the trick is to do what you want and stay alive just the same. And I have lived. I lived in your reckless touch, this flood. It was enough. You succumbed to sleep, and then I watched you each time our bodies reflected in a crystal and glass paperweight. I watched your face as you slept. The rats were miles away.
I think that's such a good example of what we were talking about earlier, a poem which is very much about character, but says so much about the world.
Yeah.
That I can't remember the exact line, but there's a line that the trick is to
do
what
you
want and manage
but
stay alive.
Yeah. Well, I was writing that while I was also very heavily involved in campaigning as well. And I was thinking, I mean, when anybody who's involved in any political campaign will know this, that you can get so consumed by it that you forget to be human almost, you know. So that was very much on my mind when I was writing the poem as well, about how do you give so much of yourself to an issue, but actually keep your feet on the ground and not get too caught up in the sort of inside bubble, because if you're campaigning for social change, then you've got to talk to people, you know, you've got to not just get lost in your own head. So yeah, that was all sort of pouring into that poem while I was doing it.
Do you find with that sort of poem, when you read it or perform it, how does the audience react? Do you get a sense of...
I've had pretty good feedback about that one. It's been quite nice. But before I do it, I obviously have to do a bit of audience interaction, and I just sort of try and get them to remember 1984 and what actually happens in it, because there's a lot of references, victory products, the rats, so the crystal paperweight. Most people don't actually remember that, but so I get them to kind of remember the story, and then I tell them a little bit about the story as quickly as I can, obviously, because as obsessed as I am with Orwell, I know that not everybody is. So, and then they can sort of hear it. But it's a love poem in general, and so as well as about Julian Winston. So hopefully people who've never read it will like it as well.
Maybe even go read 1984.
Who knows?
That would be a good effect. Yeah, it's such an amazing book. Do you find, what are your influences for your poems? Is it other books you read? Is it your experiences? Is it a little bit of everything?
Yeah, a little bit of everything. And I've been quite lucky, a lot of the jobs that I've done, and even when they have been utterly hellish while doing them, are sources, I guess, sources for inspiration. So
you've got that amazing poem about the council guy, sort of.
Yeah, Stuart. I used to work as a homelessness warden for Edinburgh City Council, and I didn't write the poems while I was there, actually. I found it too difficult, but once I'd left and reflected on it, I came up with, I mean, my first book, The Things You Leave Behind, is named after a poem that isn't even in that book, actually. It made it into this book, because I got a wee bit obsessed with, like, the things that these people would leave behind in these temporary accommodation properties.
I mean, your poems usually rhyme or have rhymes in them, don't they? How do you feel about rhyme? Is that something that comes quite naturally? Is that something... I think some people either naturally or over time become really good at rhyming, so it feels... I mean, as in your poems, you never get those sort of... Let's put it this way. Mm-hmm. Some people, when they're more inexperienced at rhyming, like me, I feel like when I try to put the rhymes together, they clunk, like you hear them. Right. Whereas I feel like yours, it just feels like part of the flow of the whole poem, so you don't even notice them in a way. They just feel like a natural part of the...
Well, that's good to hear, actually, because that's what I'd quite like to do. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, some of them I purposely do try to rhyme, but I don't know if it's because I'm lazy. Like, I promise I'm not self-deprecating, but whenever I try to stick to just one one form, is that even right? One form within a poem never works. It always ends up changing loads of different times. So some bits will rhyme and some bits just won't. And then hopefully it flows well enough when I'm reading it out that I'm forgiven for that.
No, but I think it's great. I think it's one of the things that's exciting about it, because I think sometimes with form people feel they have to either write a sonnet or not write the sonnet, or, you know, that it feels so, I suppose, like a template that you either fit into or don't. And I think a much better way, and maybe when you're first learning, it's important to do that. And certainly, you know, some people are just really good at writing perfect sonnets.
Yeah,
good on them.
No, I really wish I was like that. Like, working with Rachel puts me to shame, because she's so good at, like...
Some people just have a real
she's
knack.
She's so good at
that. But I think if that kind of work with form doesn't come naturally, being able to take what you want from forms, like a refrain or a repetition, or certain rhyme schemes or types of rhyme, and just use them as feels natural to you, is wonderful, because it can mean that it all comes out sounding much more elegant and in your own voice, rather than as if you've stuffed your voice into a little box that doesn't feel comfortable.
Yeah, I think because I always write for an audience, and I'm always imagining, right, how would I say that, you know, so I never use any words that I would never... That I wouldn't use while having a pint with you in the pub. So like, I never use any phrases or things like that I wouldn't use
really
in the pub as well. And I often rehearse my poems in the pub. So that works.
But that's good, because someone was just... Our communications manager was just doing some editing, and his partner is a wonderful editor, Claire. And apparently that's her main thing, is... When you read something, is it something you would say?
Yeah.
That's quite a good way of editing certain texts. And I like that, because it probably really helps with the pretension factor.
Like, hopefully.
if it's something you would say in a pub, that's a good...
Yeah.
That's a good baseline, I think. And I think it'd be nice to talk a little bit about maybe Rallying Abroad, because it's such a fabulous event, and... It's really one of the hot tickets in Edinburgh. I love it, and every time I've been there, I had to stand at the last one, and it's a big room, but it was so packed that it was standing room only.
Yeah,
so
it's going really well. We're thoroughly enjoying ourselves, I must say.
How did it come about? How do you do it? What do you like about it?
Well, Rachel and I had kind of... we'd met, I think it was August 2011, like, we were... she was trying to save the forest, I was just...
Not the woods, but the
amazing arts cafe. I'd never really been involved with forest, to be honest with you, but I'd always appreciated it being there, so I ended up hanging out there a lot, met her, and we just got on like a house on fire. So So that's how our friendship started, and from there, you know, we just, you know, we've been meeting up all the time. And I went through to Words Per Minute in Glasgow, and I'd been kind of, I'd sworn to myself when I stopped doing big words, and as this poetry was like, right, I'm never running events again, because as you know, it is so all-consuming, it's knackering. But to be honest with you, I was coming out of a relationship, I was quite bored, you know, I was like, right, I really want to do this again. So I saw Words Per Minute, and on the bill were two amazing people, Billy Letford and Caroline Bird, and I was like, they're doing exactly the kind of thing that I wanted to do with this poetry, which is they are poets who work equally well on the page and on the stage, and they are amazing. So,
gosh, that's a good bill.
Yeah, isn't it? I know. Kudos to Kirsten Innes. It was an awesome bill. And there was Becky Wallace, the musician of that. She was amazing. And so Rachel and I just got talking about what kind of night would you like to do? And I was like, well, I never want to run a such straight poetry night ever again, because I've done that. And, and so we just started looking at who we knew, and she was like, oh, I know some amazing puppeteers and dancers and all this, because I was like, right, okay. So and then Rally Broad was born. We booked the venue, we're like, right, bloody hell, we better have a name for this.
How did
thing.
You come up with the name?
The name is hilarious, to be honest with you. We sat for ages and ages with two, we knew we wanted it to be something and something. And we knew we wanted like the style to sort of be old school cabaret-ish looking. We thought, yeah, we'll come up with like names for ourselves, you know. And Rally the Troops is the name of a poem that has been kicking my ass for about 5 years. I've never been able to finish it. So that's where the Rally came from. And Broad is one of Rachel's first poems that she wrote for performance. So it became Rally and Broad.
So great.
We did sit with two jam jars for ages, pulling out separate words. And then we're like, why don't we just use one of our poems? There we go, that'll do.
This is two poets trying to name something.
I know.
That's what happens.
I know, it's insane. And now it's just stuck. And people often do a double take. They're like, what's the name of it? Rally, what? And quite hilariously, we just got an email from somebody looking for Mike Broad of the Rally Car Championship. And we were like, no, that's
no,
not
no,
us.
No. I've been quite enjoying this. I was emailing you guys about something last week and hadn't somehow thought of this, but enjoying shortening it to R&B.
R&B,
that's
good.
It's got a little.
Yeah, it has become R&B.
Yeah. Do you enjoy the programming, the curatorial?
Love it. Yeah, I love putting together a bill, and then Rachel and I would go, oh, that's a kind of, I mean, we're essentially extremely lucky because we're programming events that we would like to go to, so we hope that other people seem to enjoy
it
as well.
I think that's a real key to programming. I think I've got a real, if you build it, they will come, and if you put on things mm-hmm. that you'd pay a fiver for or mm-hmm. whatever, then you're more likely to get other people.
Yeah, so our first season that we did was completely funded by ourselves, and we do have a very strict policy that everybody gets paid. And I think, and that's something I feel quite strongly about as a promoter, if you are charging an entry fee, you must pay your acts. So obviously Rachel and I didn't get paid whatsoever. Aww. I mean, we paid everyone's travel, we tried to pay as professional a fee as we possibly could to all of the acts who were giving up their time. And it was a massive, massive financial risk. So we were really lucky. We got Creative Scotland funding for season two. It did take that edge off a little bit.
Yeah.
So, but we're currently fingers crossed for season three. Ooh. So we'll find out.
Well, you certainly deserve it. So hopefully that will.
Did
happen.
You hear that? Did you?
Creative Scotland.
Can we have some money, please?
Wonderful and must continue.
Because as you know, it's just exhausting promoting.
Oh, it's especially when you're doing it.
I mean, I was doing it as a teacher, as a full-time teacher, and it's just
unbelievable.
Absolutely exhausting.
Yeah, I mean, it's my job now, which is a dream come true, but like, it's exhausting even when you're getting paid a salary to do it.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Certainly, having done it for many years on top of doing a full-time job, it just takes everything out of you. So it definitely deserves to be supported, and it's a really amazing night. And if you are in Edinburgh and can go to Rally and Broad, do, because it's fabulous. And do you have anything coming up in the festival?
I mean, personally, Rachel and I have sort of separate things, but with Rally and Broad, we have What do we have? We have loads, actually. Oh, yes, we're doing the Festival of Politics, and we're doing a sort of spoken word journey from the past to the future. We've got Liz Lockhead and Kieran Hurley exploring Scotland's political past.
Wow.
We've got Harry Giles and Alan Bissett looking at the referendum. And we've got Rachel Amy and Tracy S. Rosenberg looking at, you know, potential futures for Scottish politics. So that was a great one to put together and to programme, because it's a wee bit different to what we usually do. We've also got the closing Unbound show at the Book Festival, which we're mega excited about. So we're going to do one of our special ampersand editions, where we get to different artists, put them together and say, create something lovely. So I'm going to be working with Lake Montgomery, which I'm really excited about, because she's such a brilliant musician. We've got Don Patterson for that one as well. He's going to do some stuff with some musicians as well, hopefully. Rachel's working with a new international, and we've got Ryan Van Winkle and Withered Hands. So it's quite a bill, so that's going to be great fun. And separately, we're both doing a lot during the book festival, actually. I'm running a political show, National Collective Presents, that has tons of spoken word on it, as you can imagine. And yeah, Rachel's doing a really interesting one at the book festival called Voices in the Dark, where she's going to be reading in the dark.
Oh.
And Billy Lefford's on the bill as well. So I think that'd be really interesting, because she's got such a brilliant voice as well, doesn't she? So,
yeah.
So yeah, lots of interesting things happening.
Busy.
Yep.
So somehow I feel like I can guess what you're going to vote in September.
Yeah. Is it all of the yes badges on my bag?
Are you excited for what poetry might come out after the vote?
To be honest with you, I think, I don't know if it's just because I'm really lazy, but I tend to write my better poetry after something's happened. I'm looking forward to getting cracking with I've got so many pieces that started, but to be quite honest with you, I've just been far too busy to be disciplined enough to take the time to finish them. Lots of things looking at, I mean, what's happened to Scottish culture in the last couple of years, particularly with the referendum, the different things that people are doing, and actually thinking quite a lot about the way that I myself have viewed Scottish culture since I was younger, and also since I started out as a poet. I mean, when I moved to Edinburgh, I was like, right, bloody hell, I'd better get rid of this accent, hadn't I? You know? So I'm trying to reclaim my own accent at the moment as well, because the cringe was alive and well in me until a few years ago, I think. So it's been really interesting looking at that at the same time as getting back into the poetry scene, because it kind of took a couple of years to go away.
I think sometimes you know that actually there's a lot to be said for or it's necessary actually to, I don't know, give yourself the perspective on a place or a time in order to write about it. You know, I think I couldn't write about America till I lived in Scotland for a while, or know, it can be that thing of you need somehow, maybe even the writing is a part of processing something, so it has to have happened in order. And also, you know, when you are busy, having that time and space to kind of let it all come out, because it can be hard to always be squeezing poems in the midst of all the 600 other things you're doing. Do you have any advice for poets who maybe are interested in trying out performing and haven't had much experience with that?
A few different tips. And something I do is, YouTube is amazing. There's loads of different things that you look at there. But looking at different styles of public speaking that aren't even poetry, you know, if you look at all of if you look at politicians, for example, it's quite easy to see what a lot of them do wrong. So you can kind of like watch that and make a wee list of, right, okay, don't do that, and particularly the issues with using plain language. I think if you're performing poems or reading poems out, make sure you know that in between your poems that you are talking to the audience, because it's a conversation you're having, and allowing the audience to kind of see a bit of you is really important. But essentially, yeah, just getting out there and trying it. There's so many open mic nights, and one of my favourite ones is Blind Poetics, actually. I think it's just a lovely, sort of really open, it can be a wee bit rowdy sometimes, but it's a really nice atmosphere and a lot of newcomers, and
yeah.
And Inky Fingers as well is great at the Forest.
Yeah, and go along to nights and see
Totally. Poets are terrible for that, aren't they? They're sometimes, you know, just not going to see amazing acts.
It's hard because I know everyone's busy and a lot of people like me are poor and you know, that combination can make it difficult, but I swear you learn something every time you go.
Definitely.
And it's, you learn from stuff you like, you learn from stuff you don't like. It's just, it's so important, I think, to know the context that you're working in and to make connections with other people.
Yeah, and to know the history of the scene as well, I think, is really important. Like, there's nothing worse than sort of bursting onto the scene saying, I invented this new thing called spoken word. Really, really dear, did you? I have the rigorous proof otherwise.
And the ink stained fingers, and the sore throat.
And the sweating of blood. You know, knowing places, spoken word scene, I think, is very important.
Oh, well, Jenny, it's been so nice to spend some time with you.
Yes, it's been lovely
chat. Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to all the stuff you've got coming up.
Cool.
But it'd be fab if you wanted to leave us with a poem.
Okay.
Well
I'll leave you with the title poem. It's quite a short one, but it's actually my shortest poem ever.
Oh.
As a performance poet, my poems are similar in length to the Bible. But this is the shortest poem I ever wrote, and it became the title poem on my pamphlet, The Egypt Pit. And it was actually, should I admit this? It was written with magnetic poetry magnets on my fridge. James Harding, the wonderful editor at Studio Bar P, gave me them for my 30th birthday. And I wrote this, The Egypt Pit. Jaggy, numpty, mooth, wheeshed with your chitter. The nicked was sayed and jiggered, near a thraggy claes, trapped on the Egypt Pit. Our fear kissed away, we carry it. Broshugal, Monu, Bidean, Fair Morn, Isney Close.
Thank you for downloading this Scottish Poetry Library podcast. For further information about the Scottish Poetry Library, visit our website at www.scottishpoetrylibrary.org.uk, follow us on Twitter at @ByLeavesWeLive, and find us on Facebook.